Hey, pull up a chair. It's Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy.
On the monthly draft report, going forward, why should anyone trust the numbers?
Well, that's
and
the
if
big
you're...
thing. You're right. No, you're right. Why should anybody trust numbers? You go back to election day. Look what happened 2 or 3 days before with massive, wonderful job numbers trying to get him elected or her elected, trying to get whoever the hell was running. Because you go back and they came out with numbers that were very favorable to Kamala.
So, Heilman, first of all, the last jobs report I went back and looked at in October of 2024 was terrible.
It was really bad.
And all this year, whenever they got good jobs numbers, these guys embraced them. And it's like you find yourself saying, maybe the guy's not on the level. You know what I mean?
First time that's occurred to you, Axe?
Yeah, I'm a late adopter. Okay?
Oh, my God.
I'm a late adopter. But I'll tell you one guy who's experienced this is our old buddy, former Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who my discussion partner on CNN often, and a courageous example and a rare one of someone who was willing to stand up to Trump within his own party.
You know, we should have listened to Adam. We should have listened to him earlier. He kept telling us, David, that Trump was not on the level. And we kept saying, oh, Kinzinger, he's just, you know, whine and complain and bitch and moan.
I thought it was because he wasn't made Secretary of Defense. But
right.
Because
right,
right. He's a career military guy. Why not?
Yeah.
Certainly, Adam, you are as qualified as the current Secretary of Defense, and I would argue more.
God, David, you're starting insulting mode this morning.
Adam is a courageous flyer who actually is a war fighter and a peacekeeper. Speak for yourself, Kinzinger.
First off, thanks. I've got a 3.5-year-old son, and I think he has the same qualifications for Department of Defense. I mean,
your 3.5-year-old son is a drunk? What are you talking about?
That's why he's maybe a little more qualified.
Breaking news here on Hacks on Tap. Kinzinger's 3.5-year-old.
We don't start until 5. He's still got another year to go. What was it? Yesterday or today or I don't even, timelines run together. The DOD quote unquote rapid response tweet went out saying, you know, they had a picture of Hex. It's like Hex, the Secretary of Defense has great genes. You know, a takeoff of, and I'm like, you know, look, hey, at least, you know, parents who have young adult kids who are at war, at least they know DOD's got their priorities right. It's owning the libs. It's not necessarily keeping their kids safe. It's like owning the libs and jumping headlong into the Sidney Sweeney thing. So
were they talking about his pants?
Yeah, he had jeans.
Hold on a second. Axe, do you know anything about the Sidney Sweeney controversy?
Just vaguely. I didn't follow it that closely.
Okay. I just wanted to double check on that because I'm pretty sure most of this conversation was just going right by Axe. Like, that's the whole question about the jeans thing, Axe. That's the whole thing with the Sidney Sweeney thing. Are they talking about her denim pantaloons or are they talking about her in the eugenic sense?
So they were making a play on that.
Right. Because that's the kind of thing you want to do when you have a Secretary of Defense who's been accused of being a white nationalist. Is you want to make a joke about the eugenic kind of overtones of the Sidney Sweeney thing. That's got to do.
I want to get back to the economy, but since we're here, Adam, this week or this past week, the Department of Defense and West Point canceled the appointment of Jen Easterly, who ran CISA and who had spent her career in the military in very sensitive posts. She was in the National Security Council under President Obama. She was appointed to a teaching position at West Point where she had taught for decades before. And because Laura Loomer, the right-wing influencer who apparently has huge influence with Trump, turned thumbs down, they canceled her appointment. And this has been a pattern over there at Defense. So What are the practical implications of that? She was going to teach, but there are generals who have been decommissioned essentially because she and others who have no background in the military said they're not loyal enough.
Yeah. I mean, look, the implications are, and what's chilling about this is we always believe that, you know, okay, if an illegal order comes down, the generals are going to refuse it. And, you know, that's how it should be. But what's happened over this 7 months is a message has been sent, particularly with the firing of the inspectors general, with, you know, all the firing of people that are quote unquote too woke. And now this one with Jen, who was teaching social sciences. And by the way, let me take a quick second and say, I was reading, which I rarely do, reading the comments by people about this. And the number of people in MAGA that said things like, why are we training social workers at West Point? Like social sciences is somehow social work. And why do we even have social sciences at West Point? What does that have to do with war fighting? I want to just be clear to everybody that's listening right now. West Point is a military academy, but they teach real things too. It is not 24 hours a day about killing the enemy. It's a regular college just with a military side of it. So I think the implications on this is just, it's what you see in every aspect of what Trump is doing, which is like, forcing an obedience in advance, scaring people from standing up, and making it very clear, look, if you, I mean, in her case, there's nothing she could have done because this was like past history, but if you do anything to cross this administration, you're going to lose your job. And, you know, and we're losing great people in the middle of that. That's the problem. This is an example of somebody who probably could have made more money outside, probably without question money now. Yeah. And chose to serve her country and now has been fired for it.
This war fighting thing kind of drives me nuts too.
Yeah.
It's something that Hegseth likes to repeat again and again. So far as I can see, the thing that he is expert at is culture war fighting, but when it comes to actual defense issues and so on, he is, as you suggest. But let me ask you guys, and since we are Hacks on Tap, Heilman, what is the practical political effect on all of this? Does anybody care? I mean, I think they should, but does anybody, voters, man?
Which question are we talking about?
We started with
the BLS.
No, we're going to come back to that.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think most voters are tuned in to this particular, to the Jen Easterly thing. I think most,
generally to the firings and the decommissionings at the Pentagon. I agree with you.
I think there's a question, though there are these larger questions that I think some voters are tuned into. Some voters are tuned into the state of play in Israel. Some voters are tuned into the state of play in Ukraine. Some voters are tuned into when we decide to bomb Iran. And those can have political implications. I think a lot of the personnel stuff just does not register for people who are outside the political conversation. I think that these are things for the base, for the bases, I should say, you know, things that inspire a lot of outrage, sometimes justifiable outrage on the left, and things that inspire a lot of chest thumping on the MAGA right. And they don't really get escape velocity out of the social media corridor, I think, but largely, if these things translate into a military failure, an actual military failure that is, you know, evident to people, I think some of these things can come back to haunt the Trump administration politically. But so far, we haven't seen that.
Yeah, my thought, you guys, when I see the, not just Jen Easterly, but, you know, when I see generals who are shunted aside because they're viewed by Laura Loomer or others as not being sufficiently loyal and stuff, my first thought was they ought to really study why Putin's army sucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's what you're going to end up with is if your first qualification is loyalty to the president, rather than loyalty to the country, to the Constitution, and competence, you're really, really running a risk. So, John, you're right. I mean, it may show up down the line, but the risk is there.
I think what's important to talk about that is, like, why is it that the Russian army went from, you know, this vaunted, you know, machine that's invading Ukraine, and Ukraine's going to capitulate in, you know, a week at most, to really a laughing stock in the world. And if you actually look at what it is, it's so in the United States, if you're a platoon, for instance, and your platoon commander gets killed or incapacitated, the platoon sergeant takes over. If he gets killed or incapacitated, you have a next in line, the specialist. And so there's this chain of command that no matter what happens, there's people that feel empowered then to continue the mission. In Russia, and by the way, I think it's the same thing in China when we're scared of, you know, the Chinese military. If the commander of the battalion, which is thousands of people, is killed, then nobody feels emboldened to come forward and take a leadership role and make a decision. And so that's what you get when you create paranoia and everybody is scared that they're going to make the wrong decision. So while in the U.S. military, yes, we still empower, you know, sergeants, are we sending a message that, like, yeah, but don't do the wrong thing. Don't go woke. Don't do something wrong or you'll get fired. And also, by the way, that same dynamic applies in the federal government. I mean, we all know that the bureaucracy can sometimes be stale and not move if they're scared of it. But if they're empowered, in many cases, they can find savings. They can be more effective, whatever. So we're just creating this probably 10-year trajectory, depending on, you know, whether Trump's, you know, followed up by another Trump-like character of collapse.
Yeah, and let me just say, we were kind of joking around at the beginning. Adam spent 20 years in the military as a flyer, retired as a lieutenant colonel, flew in Iraq, flew in Afghanistan. So when he speaks of this, he knows what he's talking about as someone who committed his life to defending the country. So, So we've now asserted that this stuff is probably not main center cut. What is what you see when you go to the grocery store on the cash register. What you see on the is your lived experience as and the things that affect your life most immediately. So I want to play you guys this cut from Trump in the last couple of days talking about his economic performance.
You know, when I hear the Democrats, they come out with sound bites. They say prices are up under Trump. No, they're way down. I brought them way down. Even eggs. You remember the first week, Rob, I went in and they said eggs are up 4 or 5 times. It was like crazy what was happening with eggs. Don't buy eggs. I fixed that, and I fixed it rapidly before Easter and so many other things. But prices are actually way down. Prices are down for groceries. They're down for energy, oil. You see what's happening with oil. We have some states where it's $1.99 a gallon, mm-hmm. More typically $2.33 a gallon. Mm-hmm. And they were at $3.90. They were really much higher than that during terms of the Biden administration.
So that's really a bunch of bullshit. I mean, that's just not true, what he just said.
Again, David, another example where Trump may not be fully on the level. It's like the evidence is piling up.
Right. No, I understand that. But the question is, he has a philosophy. He has a life philosophy, and it's actually been affirmed a lot because he's the president of the United States, that if you just say stuff enough, Alyssa Farah Griffin, who was with us at CNN, was his communications director for a while. She said he used to say, just say it enough and they'll believe you. Is that true on economic issues when you actually have to pay your bills? You can't just go and say, but the president says I should pay $1.99 for gas, so I'm just going to pay that. Rhetorical question, you guys.
Well, I want to say on that, like, I think when he just repeats things over and over, he's giving a talking point to his people. And then he basically empowers them to go out on Fox News and elsewhere and repeat the same thing. You see this with the Epstein stuff, when he called it a democratic, you know, scandal, democratically created thing, which, by the way, somehow went off the, we don't talk about that anymore, but whatever. He said it was done by President Obama because what he wanted was all his base to go on Fox News and repeat and repeat and repeat. I do think, though, on the economic side of things, now, you know, we get into the firing of the BLS director, but on the economic things, people feel this inflation. I mean, I don't shop all that much. My wife does most of the grocery shopping, but I went the other day And I'm like, holy crap, this stuff is way up. And I mean, this is from probably the last time I did any real grocery shopping 3 months ago or something like that. And just watching the prices much higher than I even remember. People are feeling that. And I think there's probably not a lot of talking points that you can keep spewing where people aren't going to recognize that maybe things aren't going so well. Is that going to break the hardcore MAGA? I doubt it. But people on the fringe, maybe.
I think there's always the question of who are we talking about when we say that they're going to believe it? You know, there's this actually, the two topics we've just talked about are kind of the same in some sense, because there is this audience for Trump, for a lot of these things that are fairly in the weeds, right? It's like the reality is that most Americans are not consuming a lot of this information. So you got a lot of people out there who are partisans, whether it's about personnel firings, personnel moves to the Defense Department, or whether it's stuff like this, where you hear Trump making these arguments. There's an audience for it. There are millions of people who are going to believe what Trump says and are going to lean into the notion that somehow there's some conspiracy out there. Like, well, there's got to be oil. There's got to be gas prices somewhere. It's $1.99, but somehow someone's pulling one over on me in my town. And then there's a bunch of people who are, you know, calling bullshit on Trump. But in the end, it seems like the economic data, and I would say this is true in foreign policy too. If you have a foreign policy disaster, that's the world can see it. Eventually reality kicks in. People look up and go, wow, we fucked that up. And the same thing is true with economics, only on a much more day-to-day basis. You know, Joe Biden said that inflation was transitory for 2 years, and it wasn't transitory, and people knew it because they went and they bought their bacon, they bought their eggs, they bought their gas. The same thing is true of the fact that the economy generally is slowing right now. The data, the revised data, we'll get to the BLS in a second, is reflective of reality. The tariffs are having an impact. People are feeling that in their daily lives. It's harder to find a job. The prices are still stubbornly high. And for people who make the difference in elections, which is not people who are tuned into CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News and all the rest of it all day long, those people, reality is reality. And I think that ultimately that is what turns elections, are those people who are not, you know, hardcore political news consumers, either on the left base or in the right base.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I think this is actually much different than the Pentagon stuff or the personnel stuff. This is something that you test in your day-to-day life. Either you're paying more or you're paying less. And when I hear Trump say that, all I can think of is Biden traveling around the country in the fall of 2023, talking about the miracle of Bidenomics and how much it has, and honestly, there were, the economy was much stronger at that point than it was when he became president in the middle of the pandemic. But on the biggest issue in their lives, which is how much shit costs, that was not true. And I think in his case, the conclusion was not that he was bullshitting them, but that he was just out of it and not in touch with reality and failing. In Trump's case, it may be slightly different. But I think this is the ticking time bomb for him. And the question is, does the thing that always worked for him in the past, which is I'm going to sell my version of reality, alternative facts is what Kellyanne Conway called it. Does that work on this? I think I agree with you. I don't think it does in the long run, unless there's real substantive improvement.
But can I? Here's the big kind of X factor at this is, look, and it's less important today than it was 20 years ago. The talking point fact sheet that comes to Democratic leaders about what they need to hit and whatever, that matters a little less because there's so much social media and stuff. But it is essential that Democrats get their message together. And I got to tell you guys, I have no damn clue what the Democrats' message is. We are 7 months into the worst administration this country has ever seen. We are 7 months into the worst Congress this country has ever seen. I have not seen, maybe they're out there, but I haven't seen pushes for town hall meetings again by the Democrats. I don't know what I never hear them talk about the big piece of shit bill. All I'm hearing is, an occasional bringing up of something they don't like, maybe a little Epstein, maybe a little of this. If they cannot come up with a coherent message, they may win in 2026 out of default, but it's not going to be the kind of flood that we need to see. And I get so frustrated. And I, look, I've been in the position of being in the minority party in DC, and people are like, why aren't you saying this? Why aren't you doing this? And you're like, we're trying, but we're not breaking through. But it does feel like there is just not a coherent message coming from the Democrats. And unfortunately, they have to.
Well, let me, I don't disagree with you. I mean, I think what's absent is district by district, really sophisticated social media and you know, targeted media campaigns, that there are aspects of, you know, he's doing so much, and there are aspects of, you know, when he capitulates to the sugar lobby, which pours tons of money into his, and says, okay, no more corn syrup in Coke, you know, that has meaning to farmers in Iowa and the Midwest who grow corn.
Right.
What kind of communication is being done to those folks, with those folks? And there are a million different aspects of what he's doing that have personal as well as the overarching message. It's hard to have an overarching message, sure. Although this economy thing, I think, will ultimately become an overarching message. But this is day-to-day, you know, communications combat, and I don't really see a coherent war room type strategy.
Isn't there, like, kind of, there's a little bit of a challenge here, right? Again, we get in these, Trump is, you have to properly frame all questions, right? I mean, he said the other day on the CNBC interview that he wasn't going to run for president again. So one of the questions, David, to your, that we talk about here is this going to work for him? And, you know, we've seen in the course of his time at the center of American political life, that elections where Trump is on the ballot versus elections where Trump is not on the ballot are different elections.
Completely.
They're, you know, and we saw Trump's messaging did not work for him in 2018, meaning help the Republican Party. It was terrible for the Republican Party.
And he got wounded in 22 as well.
And he got wounded in 22 but still managed to survive and thrive in 2024. If he's not running for re-election and people start to really believe that, and it's true, he's not going to try to run for election. He's not going to, who knows whether he's going to try to stage some kind of a coup down the line. That's obviously a serious topic. But at the moment, he's putting out an explicit message that he's not going to seek a third term through any mechanism or means. That means we have a midterm coming up for a Republican Party with a lame duck president whose policies are really unpopular. So that's a different thing than, is Trump's bullshit going to work for him? The question is it going to work for Republicans who are running with him as a lame duck at the top of the ticket? And that, I totally agree with Adam and you, David, that, like, that calls for some very serious Democratic message work that's both broad and deep and general and specific and tailored and more omnibus. But that's a very different challenge for Democrats than dealing with, is Trump's bullshit, does it work with his base for him? Because I think it does work with his base for him mostly.
But your last point, I mean, I want to, since Kinzinger is here and hung with those guys for all those years, your last point is really important, because they may in the aggregate see that he's gone away, he's a lame duck, his messaging is hurting us and so on. But in their districts, among Republican voters, he still is a colossus who can take them down. And Adam, you once said something to me that was so profound that I repeat it all the time about, you know, how for a lot of these guys, the job is not just a job, it's their identity, and they can't imagine themselves without it. And he threatens all of that. The question is, you know, how does he continue to get away with that? And if they follow him down that path, do they imperil those people in swing districts? You know, I think that's sort of what the equation is, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, look, they absolutely imperil the people in the swing districts. The swing districts, you'll see occasionally somebody in a swing district tweets something independent, but they still don't vote independently, which drives me nuts, right? I'm sick of hearing, I was a moderate in the House, I'm sick of hearing from moderates in the House, because they're all talk and no action. But that is the risk. And if you're in a hardcore Republican district, you know, typically you would in a year, particularly under a lame duck president, in an intervening year, you would try to show some independence. Showing independence is a death knell to anybody that is a Republican in a hardcore Republican district. So they will sacrifice these swing seats, which is, again, a good thing for Democrats in that. But one of my biggest questions is, you remember, and this probably gives you nightmares, David, but like when you guys passed the stimulus in Obamacare, we were able as kind of the Tea Party Republicans to grab onto specifically that moment where, you know, Boehner is on the floor and he goes, did you read this bill? Hell no, you didn't. Right. And that stuck. I don't know why the big, beautiful bill, which Republicans used to oppose big, beautiful things and comprehensive bills, why we couldn't have had a same situation like that out of the House that we can grab on. So, yes, I think that if I'm in a swing district, I'm pretty screwed, which is why people like Don Bacon aren't going to run again. But at the same time, there's got to be a countervailing message to this.
No, I am with you. I get frustrated with activist Democrats who say, why aren't they fighting?
Right,
but yeah. Really what they want are expressions of outrage and stamping of feet, which is a lot less valuable than what you're talking about. But John, you noted that Adam mentioned the town hall meetings. When they do have them, it doesn't go very well.
So yeah, let's just play this. This is from yesterday, right? Mike Flood, a congressman from the first district in Nebraska, who beat his Democratic opponent by 20 points, winning every county in the district in 2024, came home and had faced a town hall meeting. Here are three clips in a row that we can play of his reaction to Flood. This is getting a lot of play on cable right now because he's one of the few Republicans who was like decided that he took the brave step of facing his constituents. And this is what happened to him when he tried to defend the big bullshit bill in the first district in Nebraska, in Lincoln.
Why did you cut SNAP and healthcare research?
We do not have unlimited money in the United States. And more than anything, I truly believe this bill protects Medicaid for the future. I believe it. The Republican Party, now more than ever, represents the heart and soul of the working class.
So that was three pieces of sound that are illustrative. You could have picked like 12 because they're all the same. And he just got hammered. Adam, I would be willing to bet, I don't know for certain, but I'd be willing to bet that you've never been in a town hall meeting where you've been just had a chorus, a rain down of boos, no matter what you try to say under any circumstance. And that's a guy who's defending essentially the Trump agenda. I mean, again, you never know. It's still the election's more than a year away. But if I'm him, I'm like, man, I've got some work to do between now and November of 2026.
As Kinzinger was listening to that, he had the satisfied smile of a man who's retired from the House.
That's right.
I hated town halls, and I'm just being honest. I hated them. And I want to be clear to everybody here, because this is a trick they will try to say, because I did this, try to say, like, yeah, I have town halls. I have telephone town halls, right? And that is not a real town hall, guys. It's totally scripted. Now I can reveal the secrets. A telephone town hall is not a town hall. I hated town halls, but I think they were actually pretty important because it gives you an opportunity to feel the energy of where your district's at. I did have a few town halls where I was booed because, you know, some of the left activists would show up in force. But you could kind of tell, like, ah, that's kind of an organized group there. What you're feeling, what Mike Flood felt, was not just an organized opposition. This was real, real concern. And that's why it's important for, okay, now let's say you're a congressman that doesn't do town halls. Then the district needs to be protesting his office or her office and demanding town halls. If they're unwilling to do it, hammer them for being unwilling to face their district. That's, I think, how you get a message across. And then when they ultimately are forced to do one, they're going to feel the energy out there is not maybe what they thought, because all they're doing is watching right-wing Twitter and listening to Donald Trump.
Well, let's remember that Republicans always say, there have been a lot of town halls this year that have been ugly for Republicans. And every Republican, we always hear, well, these are all just Democrats and they're all activists who've been busted in from out of state. If you took all the town halls that have been ugly like that, it is enough. It's way more than three. And three is a trend in our business. So it's way more than three. And Axe, I would just say, knowing the Democratic Party, the idea that the Democratic Party is organized enough to stage that kind of a counterinsurgency at town halls consistently yeah. over like 6 months in districts across the country, you're giving Democrats a lot more credit than they deserve.
Yeah. And let me tell you something. I still have the tire treads on my, yeah. on my ass from 2010.
Yeah.
So I know what it's like to be on the other side of this and sit in the White House. And you can tell that they know too, which is why Trump is doing two things. He's forcing Texas to redistrict to try and win seats, five seats they hope to pick up. I want to talk about that in a second. Adam sits in Texas right now, and so he probably has been watching this pretty closely. But he's also raising $1 billion as his goal, and he's well on his way to that by using every coercive tool available to him to get people to donate, because I think Trump understands that if he, you know, a Democratic House would mean accountability in a way that he doesn't have to face right now.
And David, let me say one more thing back to Adam about that town hall thing, which is, like, you know, we've all been in meetings that have had an astroturf feel to them, that, like, when you see that flood, you see the video of that flood town hall. It is just, you know, it is overwhelming. It's, sure. you know, there's hundreds of people in the room, and everything, time he tries to get a talking point out, those are not like kind of potted, canned, paid for boos. Those mm-hmm. are the boos of people who are genuinely pissed. And I guess, you know, I know you said you hated town halls, but when you get in a situation where there's widespread, deep, passionate outrage over things you're doing, that just has a different quality, a different kind of flavor. And that's very consistent with the fact that this bill, the polling shows it. You know, it's really unpopular. It's the most unpopular among anybody who knows anything about it. It's the most unpopular piece of legislation in 30 years. So that's, like, the numbers line up with what we're seeing anecdotally. And that's a real warning sign, I would think, for Republicans in Congress.
Yeah, I mean, look, politicians are really good at reading rooms. I mean, it's kind of a personality trait that makes you a good politician. And, you know, you can stand in front of a you know, whether you're speaking to a, you know, Kiwanis group or you're doing a town hall, you can feel if that room is on your side or not, and you can feel if they're out of towners or not. You just can do that. What I see in this is not AstroTurf. Certainly probably more people that identify as left are showing up than people that identify as right. But what that shows is that there's real anger and energy to compel that level of action. And, you know, again, bringing up 2010, this feels a lot like what you saw with the Tea Party in 2010, which is this kind of massive uprising of anger, people showing up to these town halls. It wasn't an organized effort. It kind of organized after that. And I think, you know, America could be sitting on another sort of Tea Party movement of, I didn't want to say the left, that's kind of this pro-democracy coalition, if this is handled right. And I think this is something that will happen organically if, in fact, this is similar to the Tea Party.
We need to take a break, but we'll be back in two shakes of a lamb's tail.
Here's some breaking news. Cats don't care about breaking news. They care about dinner. And if it's not our next partner, Smalls, prepare for some aggressive protests on your couch. This podcast is sponsored by Smalls. Smalls cat food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free ingredients you'll find in your fridge, and it's delivered right to your door. That's why Cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. To get 60% off your first order, plus free shipping, head to Smalls.com/hacks for a limited time only. And I will tell you, folks, that I have tested out this cat food with my own cats, Augie and Twizzler, and I can report that they actually do love it. So you don't have to rely on testimonials from people you don't know or cats you've never heard of. My guys really, really liked it. Smalls was started back in 2017 by a couple of guys home cooking cat food in small batches for their friends. Man, that's really good friends to have. A few short years later, they've served millions of meals to cats across the U.S. Did you know other brands make cat food with questionable ingredients? Well, they do. After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements, and their cats felt better, too. That's a big deal. So what are you waiting for? Give your cats the food they deserve. For a limited time only, because you're a Hacks on Tap listener, you get 60% off your first Smalls order, plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/hacks. That's 60% off when you head to smalls.com/hacks, plus free shipping. Again, that's smalls.com/hacks. So let's talk about this redistricting issue. Probably people listening to this podcast have been following it. The president called the governor of Texas and said, I want you to redistrict. Normally that happens once every 10 years. The governor of Texas dutifully complied, and now the legislature is trying to draw a new map that they feel will yield 5 additional Republican seats. And Democrats in the legislature have fled, we'll talk about that in a second, to try and keep them procedurally from moving forward. Adam, first of all, do you believe that this map will yield 5 new seats for Republicans?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, everybody that knows these numbers better than I do, because I'm fairly new to Texas, is saying it looks like that will be 5 new districts and not like kind of 51-49 districts, like pretty significantly Republican. And so what you're going to end up with is a state as massive as Texas with just a handful of Democrats represented it, when the state, by the way, always votes 45-46% Democratic. I mean, it's not a blowout state. And but look, they're violating a norm by doing this. I think it's wrong. But I don't necessarily think it's illegal, because according to the Supreme Court, it was a bad decision. I think the Supreme Court, 5, 6, 7 years ago, said a state can redistrict basically using politics however they want, in essence confirming gerrymandering. So that's where we are. And Democrats better be ready to fight back on this, I think.
Yeah, listen, I just want to say one thing on the map. There's an interesting piece, I think, in the Times this morning from Texas. A lot of this is predicated, a number of these districts are in urban areas. A lot of them are down in South Texas, and they're predicated on Hispanic voters coming out in the same numbers for Republicans.
And in the same percentages, like just overall, the shift of Hispanic loyalties towards Trump being transferable more broadly, the Republican Party in a lasting way.
I think that's questionable. I think that this is a constituency that is hugely sensitive to these economic factors we were talking about earlier. I think that they were with Trump on the border enforcement. I'm not sure, but I don't think that they're necessarily with Trump on the sort of ICE overreach. You've got incumbents there who have long-term relationships with a lot of these voters who won while Trump was on the ballot. So, you know, I think it's a gamble that they're going to win those seats. But in terms of Democrats fighting back, Heilman, you know, you see what's going on in California, where they believe, I know talking to Democrats there, they believe they can squeeze 5 more seats out. I mean, and then let me just play Kathy Hochul in New York, the governor.
Republicans take over the legislature, they can have at it. But until then, we're in charge, and we're sick and tired of being pushed around when other states don't have the same aspirations that we always have had. And I hold those dear. But I cannot ignore that the playing field has changed dramatically. And shame on us if we ignore that fact and cling tight to the vestiges of the past. That era is over. Donald Trump eliminated that forever.
So she was talking about the fact that New York has a, you know, sort of a modified system that takes politics out of map making. And she's saying, screw that. They're playing tackle. We can't play touch. And so we're in an arms race now.
I mean, it's a core question, right? And Better O'Rourke has been as loud about this as anybody, basically saying something that I have agreed with, not from the partisan standpoint, but just from the observational standpoint as a reporter. The first time I really keyed in on this was in the recount in 2000 in Florida, where it was just very clear that Al Gore and his people were like trying to figure out some way to do the right thing and be adhere to democratic principles and somehow win the election on the fair, on the up and up and on the level. And that Jim Baker and Lee Atwater and the rest of those guys who were down there were kind of like, this is about power. We have to win. We'll do whatever we have to do to win this election because we got to be president next time, guys. And we don't care if people are mad at us or if we look like thugs, we're just going to get this done. And I think that's what Beto has thrown into sharp relief. Are Democrats ready to basically say, that is what matters? What matters here is not this whole idea of nonpartisan redistricting was a very good and admirable goal. Some Democratic states have undertaken it. Some have not. Some have tied themselves in legal knots over. They're going to be hard to get out of. But in principle, are Democrats now ready to say Trump has changed the game? And because of the way Trump has changed the game, at least for the foreseeable future, we are going to have to play this game as ruthlessly as Republicans do, where power is the point, not being right. And I don't know the Democrats. Some Democrats have the stomach for that, but I don't think all Democrats have the stomach for that.
Yeah, but you know, I think the most active Democrats do have a stomach for it. And it's interesting because the three, you know, Governor Hochul has a primary for governor there. You've got Gavin Newsom in California who wants to run for president.
He has the stomach for it for sure. There's no doubt about that.
J.B. Pritzker in Illinois.
Also the stomach for it, yeah.
Yeah, no, okay, yep. All right.
No. You heard that the wrong way. This is one where you said one I impute. I won't say what you want to impute, but I will say JB Pritzker wants to be seen as
I weighed that wrong. Sorry.
JB wants to be seen as a fighter, and so does Newsom. They're going to win if they're going to be competitive in the presidential primary. They want to be seen as fighters, and they're going to do what they need to do.
And the Texans have fled to various states where governors would stick up to them. One of them is Illinois. Adam, you must have seen some irony in that, huh?
Yeah, listen, for those that don't know, I was redistricted out of my district twice in Illinois. I was targeted by the Democrats. So that happened in 2012 when I was drawn in with Don Manzullo, another Republican. I was supposed to lose that. I won. And then it happened, you know, when I finally decided to hang it up. I'm not bitter about it because I understand it. And frankly, I probably wasn't going to run for Congress regardless anyway. But it is ironic that, you know, these Texas legislators flee to Illinois, and Illinois is probably the biggest example of Democratic gerrymandering around. Look at the map. And that's why, so when people talk about, well, you know, there's New York and California, and I believe they do need to basically open fire again here, because I think, as much as I hate, like, we're going to go low when they go low because it just kills democracy in the long run, they are cheating, in essence, and we're going to have to be willing to match that. But for those that think there's a great hope in Illinois to squeeze another district out or
that's not going to happen.
There is not. That has been squeezed.
Just for so people know, there are 17 congressional seats in Illinois. 14 of them are Democrats. That's 82%
right.
of the seats. And while Illinois is a Democratic state, it's like I think in the last election, I have to go back and look.
It's like 56-44.
Yeah, it's like a 55-45 kind of situation.
And
here,
listeners, trust us. David Axelrod you would not want to know the number of hours David has spent trying to get those last three congressional districts.
Yeah, exactly.
How do we get, if we could re-engineer those things to get us to 100%?
Spent many days of my life saying, how do we get Kinzinger out of this state?
Yeah, that's right.
But now I can enjoy life because of you, so thank you.
This was done all for you, my friend.
I appreciate
that.
It's very kind.
If it wasn't for Donald Trump, you guys would hate each other. But, you know, because of Donald Trump, Adam's now like, David, thank you for forcing me out of elected politics. I appreciate that.
Not true.
You'll be the godfather to my next child.
Okay, then let's take a break right here, and we'll be right back. Speaking of cheating, this Epstein thing. First of all, Adam, I mean, there were new developments we need to talk about. But explain from the Republican standpoint and from the base standpoint why this has been so different than other things and why it holds such a level of importance to those voters.
So Epstein theory is a religion in the right. So, you know, and this actually is a thing that comes from Russia, where they accuse their opponents of being pedophiles. But since 2019, kind of 2020, Republicans have taken to accusing Democrats of pedophilia, you know, against all odds. I mean, what, 90% of the pedophiles we end up seeing arrested anyway are Republicans. But, and so what, you know, you look back to the Pizzagate shooting,
yeah, where supposedly 16,
women,
yeah,
kept, yeah, women, kept, you know, kids kept in the basement. You look at QAnon, the whole QAnon thing is about this, you know, global elites who drink children's blood. And then you have Epstein gets arrested. He kills himself in prison, but then, you know, it becomes, oh no, he was killed by probably Hillary Clinton. And so it became this religion. And every Democrat and every apostate Republican like myself was accused of being on the Epstein file. And so Donald Trump used that to run for office. And I mean, this is not an insignificant number of people that this is their religion. I mean, you listen to the Joe Rogans, you listen to, you know, the kind of bro podcasters, this is their big thing. And so Donald Trump wins, promising transparency. We see all this through, and then all of a sudden they're not going to bring it. And it is probably a bigger sin in the GOP to have done what they're doing on Epstein than if Donald Trump would have said, like, he doesn't believe in Jesus Christ or something like that. It is their religion. And so they're really going through some things right now, particularly as they try to kind of crawl their way out of this and find a way to defend Donald Trump against their, you know, their, his violation of their religion.
This last week, John, Trump sent, I mean, he says he had nothing to do with it. The Justice Department sent Todd Blanche, his former defense attorney, deputy attorney general, down 2 days virtually alone with Maxwell. And then shortly after that, she gets shipped to a prison farm in Texas that is significantly less arduous than the place she was. And Trump continues to talk about he will not take pardon off the table. Yeah. So what do you make of all that? And what do you think people make of all of that?
I think people who are not just far right, who are not just MAGA, who are not just, let alone as far right as QAnon, I think a lot of people think the whole thing stinks. And it looks obviously, the prima facie evidence is Donald Trump is hiding something and he is protecting powerful people. You do not have to think that there's a cabal of Democrats and Jews who are trading in young children and drugs, you know, to believe that Jeffrey Epstein was a heinous pedophile, maybe the most notorious pedophile, public pedophile that we know in the last 100 years in America, who engaged in all kinds of sickness and all kinds of depravity, and who hung around with a lot of famous, powerful people in academia, in science, in finance. He was the ultimate insider. All the stuff that Trump is supposed to be against, that, you know, the grievance of normal people who think that elites are pulling one over on them and condescending to them and get away with everything and play by a different set of rules. All that stuff that Trump masterfully capitalized on politically, he's now protecting that set. Jeffrey Epstein is the ultimate example, apart from being a pedophile, is the ultimate example of an Upper East Side New Yorker who hangs around with some British lady who procures underage girls for him and then hangs out with people like Bill Gates and Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. And it's like, there are a lot of people who are not crazy base people who say, you guys told us up until, you guys had an event at the White House where you said, Jeffrey Epstein part one, it's all going to come out. And then for the administration to come out and say, nothing to see here, please look away. Also, by the way, Donald Trump saying, you're stupid if you believe this. Mm-hmm. I mean, going on Truth Social and attacking your base for believing a conspiracy theory that you peddled, I think is politically incredibly dangerous for Trump. And I think everything he's doing begs the question, why? Like, it's just on the surface, the Occam's razor thing is he's scared of what fully unleashing the Epstein files would what that would bring for him.
Maxwell holds the key to
that. Maxwell holds the key. So it's like all of it, you know, I don't have any inside dope on this, except I think a lot of people look at this and go, man, this stinks. It's fishy. And that's why you're starting to see people like Rogan and Andrew Schultz, the people who are not hardcore MAGA, but were on board for this, looking to Trump and going, man, you are just another, like another fucking politician. You're just another elite politician shitting on us and treating us like you can gaslight us and get away with it. I think it's dangerous for Trump politically.
So, Adam, how is all of this being received? Because now you see, like, on some of the right-wing stations and stuff, a sort of softening about Maxwell. Well, she was kind of a victim herself. I mean, she recruited these young girls. She groomed them.
Yeah.
And then she participated in the assault.
She pulled their panties off.
So so how are people receiving this?
It's weird because it's hard to tell. I think, again, kind of your what's left of the not hardcore MAGA Republicans, and obviously everybody else thinks there's something fishy here, but there are certain people that are trying desperately to believe that there's nothing here. And they, you know, humans are very capable of convincing themselves of anything. And so if you've supported Donald Trump for 10 years, you have to convince yourself he's not a pedophile. And I saw on Newsmax the other day, for instance, one of the anchors saying, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell was a victim. The deep state media has been trying to make her look bad because X, Y, and Z. And so those talking points are being given to the hardest core MAGA. I am not confident that this continues to be an issue among Republicans. And maybe that's just because I've been burned for so long, but I really do have concern that this ends up just kind of going away. And everybody just quits talking about it. And that's why I think it's important for people to keep it up.
We've been talking about it all this show. Do you think that this will in any way contribute to their difficulty in getting sort of these marginal voters who don't usually participate but come out for Trump to come out in the midterm elections? Can you pin the reps in those districts with being part of the cover-up?
Sure. Yeah, I think you absolutely can and should. I mean, again, they ran out of Congress so that they didn't have to vote on a resolution which should be coming up in September, which is why they're trying to get everybody off of thinking about this. They left a week early. Yes, this should be pinned on them. Do they, every time they are asked a question, they should be asked, do they support releasing everything in the Epstein files? I think it will have an impact in that. Anytime, as you guys well know, for a low propensity voter, anytime you attack or bring down their enthusiasm by even an iota of a degree, they're much less likely to turn out and vote. And what you're seeing now is exactly that. Republicans now have the same issue that Democrats had kind of under Obama, where Obama invigorated people to come out and vote, and then in an off year, they weren't really as invigorated. So, yeah, I think it will have an impact.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
You know, we got you here. So, and I want to tax your expertise. You know, one thing that I'm sure you watched with interest last week was that Trump got pissed because Medvedev, the former president.
Bingo. Well done.
The former president of Russia trolled him. And so he repositioned nuclear submarines closer to Russia.
I'm willing to bet, by the way, they weren't repositioned, but they were already there.
I see.
Yeah. I don't love playing with the nuclear saber at all. But just so you guys know, I mean, I don't think it's any secret that we always have nuclear subs positioned around China, around Russia. That's the point of the nuclear subs. But what'll be interesting to see here in Ukraine is, Look, there is what I don't like. So Terry Virts, who's running as a Democrat for Senate here in Texas, made a comment that I thought was profound. He said, you know, when a hurricane hits Texas, I go outside and I help my neighbors and I'm helpful. I help them clean up. I do whatever. But he goes, we then go to the Home Depot and we buy stuff that we need there. Home Depot is not helping us. Home Depot is a marketplace where they can sell us stuff because of this tragedy. We like having Home Depot there, but they're not helpful. And he said, that's what the United States has become around the world, particularly in Ukraine. Yes, it's good that Donald Trump has said that NATO allies can buy American weapons and give them to Ukraine. I guess that's better than where we were in January when we thought we fully switched sides to the Russians. But what's happened to America's reputation and to our soul when all of a sudden we're unwilling to give things to a country that's being attacked by the way, one of our chief enemies. We spend at least half of our defense budget posturing against the Russians. We're unwilling to give them things because America first and whatever else. So I feel like the moral damage to our soul in this is going to be something that's going to take maybe a generation to repair. In the meantime, I'm glad we've set up the Home Depot to at least sell them weapons because they need them. But I just, you know, I wish we weren't in the merchant business as much as we were in the global leadership business.
I think often about the hangover from Iraq and Afghanistan and the inward turning of people. I should be up on this. I'm not, but I imagine that the selling of stuff probably is a politically palatable position to take because Americans are of the view, especially when you're cutting all this other crap, like, why are we giving this away?
Yeah.
On the politics, he probably found a kind of sweet spot where he can not be accused of helping the Russians and not be accused of funding the Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, and that's where I'm going to be critical of the Biden administration here. They did a lot for Ukraine. And compared to Trump, obviously, you know, night and day difference. But what they didn't do very well is A, explain the mission, but also explain the fact that when we gave stuff to Ukraine, what we were doing was actually getting rid of our old shit. The stuff that we were getting ready to destroy, we gave it to Ukraine because they were going to burn through it. And then the only reason it had a value assigned to it is because we had to buy replacement stuff, which we were going to buy anyway. So really the cost of what we gave to Ukraine for the most part was almost zero. It would have been spent anyway. And I just don't think the administration did a good job of explaining it. And there was just this belief that we wrote a $100 billion check. We gave it to Zelensky. 20% of it disappeared into some black hole. And nothing could be further from the truth.
It'll be forever debated as to whether they throttled down Ukraine too much at a time when they had Russia on the run.
Yes.
And could have perhaps finished the job. They didn't supply the weapons that they needed to finish that job. But that will be for history to decide. Where do you think this thing ends and how?
I think ultimately, I mean, it obviously ends in a negotiation to some level. What you have now are two powers that are just, it's like two boxers in the ring in the ninth round, just kind of hitting each other. I think Russia's, I mean, the X factor here is the Russian economy really could, we could wake up tomorrow into a complete full panic in the Russian economy. I think this ends, so it ends in a negotiation. The question is to whose benefit? If Donald Trump would stand up and say, we are on the side of Ukraine, Ukraine will not lose this, it would end in Ukraine's benefit. Because I think what Putin is doing is buying time to see if he can outlast the United States. And so, look, ultimately, you will not, and I would put $100 million on this, you will not see Ukraine completely fall to Russia. I mean, they're fighting, they're good. They're producing 4 million first-person view drones a year now, which are those explosive drones. So Ukraine's got that. But the question is how many more people, Russians and Ukrainians, have to die? And I think that, frankly, is in the hands of Donald Trump and what kind of a position he takes. And does he actually take the side of Ukraine and let Putin know that he can't win this war?
The headline, John, is that Adam Kinzinger has $100 million to bet. So retirement yep. is really working out well for him.
Yeah, it's great. I love it.
Adam, I just want to get on one last thing related to this, which is, you know, all this discussion about Putin there's a, it'd be an interesting thing, which is kind of what the U.S. policy is to Russia versus what, you know, Trump has taken to of late, you know, expressing his upset, you know, Vladimir, you know, stop doing this, stop right. doing that. He's like, you know, is Trump pissed with Putin? Like, we personalize that thing an awful lot. But it is interesting to me that there's this kind of a line of analysis that kind of points to the similarity between how Trump has dealt with Putin and dealt with Netanyahu, where these two guys who he seems to see through his normal kind of transactional prism, which is they confound him on some level, where it's kind of like, you know, he angles around them, he negotiates with them, he sometimes browbeats them in public, he sometimes breaks with them, most recently with Netanyahu, you know, suddenly last week it was like, you know, yeah, there is starvation in Gaza, Bibi. There really is. You can't deny that there's starvation. And we kind of came close to saying that there was a starvation policy there. But that somehow these kind of guys, the part of the problem for Trump is that they have their objectives. And their objectives are not they kind of don't operate at the transactional level that Trump does. You know, Putin wants Ukraine. He doesn't want peace. He doesn't want a negotiated settlement. And that ultimately is the thing that stymies us there. Talk about the way in which that kind of also is playing out in Israel, where, you know, for all of the international outrage right now and all the pressure on Trump and Trump's seeming break with Bibi last week in a little bit of at least at a minor level, we now hear Netanyahu basically talking internally in Israel about, we're going all in on occupation. We're just going to take Gaza. You know, that seems like something kind of Trump invited when he talked about turning the Gaza Strip into the Florida coastline at one point. You know, all of that is just super interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think Netanyahu, first off, knows that Donald Trump's not going to turn on him. The political pressure is too great in the party. He won't do it. Netanyahu knows what his goal is, and his goal is to, frankly, feels like at some point prolong this war. I honestly think, looking back, Israel fought the wrong war in Gaza. They should have actually fought a counterinsurgency, which is basically take over Gaza, build, hold, clear, like we did in Iraq under the surge, which was very successful. Instead, Gaza's been destroyed because they'll just bomb stuff. I think what you see with the dynamic between Netanyahu and Putin is what the dynamic that exists here in the United States that people need to realize, which is when you stand up to Donald Trump, he always backs down. I mean, it's like we see this with these people that are being attacked by, you know, the DOJ, and they're doing investigations, and then these people go super quiet, and they, you know, like when you stand up to Donald Trump, he doesn't know what to do and he backs down. And so you see that in Putin and Netanyahu, which is where you get this kind of confusing relationship where Trump will stand up to them. They don't do what Trump wants, and he doesn't know how to respond to that because ultimately Donald Trump truly is a coward. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that same dynamic is at play everywhere. And so we'll see.
Just to try to tie up all these topics, because, you know, we started with the BLS, and one of the things that people have said on the basis of, you know, Trump tried to basically eradicate identifiably accurate objective statistics in our government is an authoritarian move. And if you've rattled off the list of the topics that we've covered on this episode today, a lot of them point towards this larger question that hovers over all our discussions, which is like, are we on our way to being hungry? I'd love to hear from you and Adam on your assessment of where we are in that trajectory
now. Listen, I said all throughout the campaign and since that if you know, we talk about Project 2025, and he's certainly following that, even though he said he wouldn't. But there's also a Project Hungry, and he is doing exactly what Orban did in Hungary to transform it from a real democracy to a democracy, you know, in form only. He went after the independent media, and it's no longer an independent media. 80% of the media outlets there are government. Are basically controlled by him. He went after the universities. He purged the courts and filled them with judges who were friendly to him, and went after lawyers. He also has enriched himself to extraordinary degrees, and his family. He's doing all the things. He did all the things that Trump did, but it took him years to do it. Trump's done it in 6 months. And that's, I think, what's alarming here. That, you know, one would think that American institutions and American leadership would hold up better to authoritarian pushes than the one than what we've seen. And I think I don't know, Adam, that that to me is sort of the story.
Here's another way of asking this question, Adam, which is I bet you agree with everything David just said, as do I. But the pace of it has been the striking thing. And right. I will say that back in 2017, the thing that people used to stop me in the street and say is, are we going to be okay? And now people more stop and say, how fucked are we? Mm-hmm. And that kind of goes to the pace at which this is all happening. Just talk about that. Are you surprised by how quickly all this is happening and how little resistance there really has been?
I mean, I'm blown away by it. I mean, I never, so look, even my worst case scenario I went through in my head, I never imagined we would ever actually get to this point in 4 years, much less get here in 7 months. And again, the whole thing is that people, and I was talking about this with the foreign policy stuff, people who should be standing up and saying no. Law firms, for God's sakes, you have free lawyers out there, right? If you're a law firm, you got free people that can fight this through the courts. Law firms capitulating. I never saw that coming. And it basically gets me to the point where I believe, like, all we really have left is taking to the streets, because all the institutions we were relying on are gone. And, you know, my only other hope is that, you know, it's kind of like when you were in grade school and you ran the mile, and you always had that one kid that took off and ran as hard as he could, and then about one quarter of a mile in, he was sucking air. And I'm hoping maybe that's the case here, that they've gotten everything out of the way and now they kind of fall apart. But if they don't, I don't know what this country looks like when we come out.
Yeah. That kid wasn't 80. There's that. But
yeah, that's true. That is true.
Listen, you know, you say take to the streets. Honestly, it does speak to the importance of this next election as well, because if you do believe in democracy and you want to save democracy, that's the ultimate tool that you're handed. And the question is whether people take advantage of it. We got to run. I want to apologize to our listeners. We did not do a mailbag this week, but send them to hacksontap@gmail.com, or we really, really invite your voicemail messages. And here is the number courtesy of AI-generated Mike Murphy.
773-389-4471. I'll repeat it because who can remember that? 773-389-4471. X is the best co-host ever.
Yeah, it's incredible what you can do with these new technologies. Adam Kinzinger, always a pleasure to sit down with you. I'm so glad that I helped participate in kicking you out of Congress so you had more time to spend with us. And Heilman, I would have kicked you out of Congress if I had a chance, but you never ran. So
let's just keep one thing in mind, gentlemen. The Cubs, the Mets, and of course the Dodgers, all in the playoff hunt simultaneously in this baseball season, which gives us something to hope for.
Listen, I've spent a lot of time at the ballpark. It's very therapeutic, though.
I know.
The Cubs have been floundering lately. So from your mouth to, I know,
they're
long season.
They're 5-5 in their last 10 games. That's not floundering. That's treading water.
Dude, I've been out there. I've been watching the games. I know what's going on here. But anyway, more on all of that later. Kinzinger, come back often, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Peace out, guys.